I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Members of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, are preparing to vote on whether to remove Jewish settlers and Israeli troops from the Gaza Strip. Settlers are gathered outside protesting a vote that will almost certainly not go their way. Meanwhile, commentators in Israel are calling this an earthquake that has already changed the country forever. Joining us from Jerusalem is John Ward Anderson, correspondent for The Washington Post. And John, it's been 2 days of very stormy debate leading into this vote. What's been going on inside the chambers?
Well, what you've got on the one hand is a huge political battle within the ruling party, the Likud party, that is the party of Prime Minister Sharon, because they're deeply, deeply divided over this. Sharon is actually looking outside his normal allies to the left wing, to the dovish parties and the peace activists, to support him on this plan, because his traditional allies and the ultra-nationalists and the ultra-orthodox parties have abandoned him and have accused him of being a traitor to the Jewish faith and to the settlers that he helped place in Gaza and the West Bank.
And I know you've spoken to protesters. How are they viewing this, what they see as a turnabout and about face on Sharon's part?
Well, they see this as the ultimate in a personal and religious betrayal. I mean, this is like for Americans, if Jerry Falwell suddenly became pro-choice. For them, they see this as the guy who is the father of the settlement project for Israel, the one who actually helped place them there, is now stabbing them in the back. They're calling him a traitor. There are placards plastered around the Knesset, Israel's parliament, calling him a liar and a traitor and a backstabber.
And he's had some words that have been startling to Israelis for his former supporters.
That's correct. I mean, in his speech before Parliament that opened this whole debate last night, he said that the Israeli settlers had to be careful of a messianic complex, which is actually a terminology that originally was used by Menachem Begin almost 20 years ago, but has been adopted by the left wing in Israel to talk about how one-sided and narrow-minded most of the settlers are.
Yeah, and by the way, he's also mentioned regret for the plight of the Palestinian refugees. That's also new language, which brings to mind. Can you explain why some Palestinians are also worried about the pullout?
Sure. Some of the Palestinians really see this. One of them told me that it was a virtual withdrawal, that in fact what they were doing was withdrawing from inside Gaza, but basically incarcerating the Palestinians there from the outside. Israel, under the withdrawal plan, will continue to control all of the access into and out of the Gaza Strip. And in fact, one of Sharon's chief advisors, his former chief of staff, has said that one of the main political aims of this disengagement plan was in fact to strengthen the hold on that Israel has on settlements in the West Bank and to freeze the political process with the Palestinians.
Yeah, we just have a couple minutes left. Could you touch briefly on what exactly is being voted on today?
Yes, they're voting on basically the whole concept of whether or not Israel should go in and remove 8,100 Jewish settlers from 21 settlements in the Gaza Strip and about another 470 settlers from four settlements in the northern part of the West Bank. And if they go ahead and do this, what it's going to enable Israel to do is destroy the houses and the synagogues that are in these settlements, pay the settlers, between $100,000 and $500,000 in compensation, and authorize the Israeli army to use force for the people who don't leave voluntarily.
Yeah. And John, we know that there's been an extraordinary amount of ominous rhetoric in Israel. We've spoken about this talk of a possible civil war, threats or perceived threats on the life of Ariel Sharon. I'm just wondering, with all of this going on in Israel right now, is anyone focusing there on the U.S. elections and the possible outcome here and what that might mean for Israel?
Very few people, actually. I think most people who have been watching the U.S. elections see very little difference between the rhetoric of Kerry and Bush and think that, and in fact, many of them have said that they would expect that Kerry is going to go on and continue with Bush's policies here in the Middle East.
And just in the few seconds we have, how badly is this expected to wound Israel, at least in the short term?
Expected to wound Israel?
The discourse and the rhetoric and the anger.
Yeah, well, I mean, the people that I've talked to said there really is a serious threat of civil war if the settlers decide that they're going to take up arms and fight the evacuation. And there's no doubt that there's a deep, deep political divide that's been opened up here and that could eventually lead possibly within the next week, to the collapse of Sharon's government.
Mm. John Ward Anderson reports from Jerusalem for The Washington Post. John, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Robin.
With the cost of gas in the U.S. topping $2 a gallon and with the Middle East in disarray, you'd think the energy policies of President Bush and Senator Kerry would be among the central issues in this campaign, but they're not. And Greg Easterbrook says that's a problem. The journalist deconstructs the plans of both camps in a recent issue of The New Republic, and he joins us to do the same. And Greg, let's start with cars. Secretary of Energy Spencer Abraham wrote a letter to Business Week in favor of the president's energy policy. It reads, among Bush's achievements, a hydrogen fuel initiative to power vehicles with domestically produced hydrogen instead of relying on foreign oil. Your thoughts?
I think Bush has done some good things. The infamous Cheney energy plan that was produced in secret and released in controversy in the year 2001 isn't anywhere near as bad as critics have made it sound. There's some good recommendations in it, very few of which have been put into effect. But as for what President Bush has actually done in office, boy, the status quo has barely changed on anything. The piece you cited mentions the hydrogen research program. It's just a research program. It doesn't have any short-term applicability to U.S. energy trends. Under the Bush administration, the Air Force has researched antimatter propulsion, and that doesn't have any relevance to our daily life either. Hydrogen may matter someday, but not in the next 10 to 20 years. And also bear in mind, hydrogen is not an energy source. It is an energy medium like electricity.
Right.
The key thing to hydrogen is it must be produced in some way, and all current practical forms of producing hydrogen entail wide-scale use of fossil fuels.
And going back to the source, to oil, where does President Bush stand on MPG standards, miles per gallon standards for cars?
He has repeatedly said that he does not favor higher miles per gallon standards for cars, or that the issue should receive further study. When he took office, he asked the National Academy of Sciences to study the issue. Inconveniently for him, the National Academy of Sciences said that with current technology, we could increase the miles per gallon of vehicles by about one-third without any sacrifice of comfort or safety. And rather than act on that, he said he wanted the study to be further studied. So he's put off the whole issue. As I must say, Bill Clinton did before him.
Well, but as a matter of fact, Senator Kerry at that time drafted a bill, as you write, with John McCain. That bill was defeated, but it called for higher standards. Now both candidates, Bush and Kerry, are looking for voters, in Michigan in particular. Given that, how is John Kerry handling the issue of fuel efficiency now?
Well, his current platform calls for a big program to increase the fuel efficiency of automobiles in two ways. First, by offering tax credits for the purchase of efficient cars, not for cars with, you know, dual fuel gimmicks and other things like that, just any car that gets high miles per gallon, you'd get up to a $5,000 per car tax credit. The goal of this would be to make fuel efficient vehicles simply more attractive as purchases than gas guzzlers, and then people make up their own minds. Secondly, Kerry would offer $10 billion in subsidies to the Detroit automakers only to retool their factories to produce more efficient vehicles. Whether these two things would add to the deficit is, I think, the unknown in his plan. He claims these programs can be financed without additional deficit spending. We'll have to skip the details here. But at least he has a solid proposal to encourage people to buy more fuel-efficient vehicles. And I don't mean Econobox death traps. I only mean buy a medium-sized SUV instead of a monster SUV. That's the sort of reform that Kerry's attempting to encourage.
But it does sound as if it comes back to how's he going to pay for it?
Yeah, the financing proposal is a lengthy one having to do with oil trust funds and other things. Yeah. And I would say that the drawback to this program is that if you offer people $5,000 tax credits for cars, there are one of two possibilities. One is that the program will be successful. Lots of people will take you up on it, and then it will involve a lot of government spending. The other possibility is that the program will flop, people won't use it, and then the government doesn't spend any money, but then you need a new idea for encouraging fuel economy standards.
There's a fear on the part of both candidates to bring this up because it offends the auto industry, it offends some people's sensibilities, you know, they're being encouraged to drive a certain kind of car. But in California, as you point out, they raised the mile per gallon standards. China made a demand raising the miles per gallon standards of cars by U.S. automakers built in China. And people did it.
Yes, California just passed a state law that would, in effect, require a one-third increase in the fuel economy of cars in about 10 years. And I think that's what we need on a national level, too, that type of goal or legislation. One of the silliest things I think you hear in this debate is people saying, no one has a right to tell me what kind of car I can drive. Well, that statement is widely believed and quite ridiculous. According to the Constitution, you've got a right to read a newspaper and a right to own a gun. Those are the two types of consumer purchases that are specifically protected under the U.S. Constitution. As for other goods, especially goods that are used in public places, and highways are a public place, remember, there are elaborate laws regulating what sorts of goods and possessions can be used in public places, and courts have always upheld them as long as they are reasonably related to the general public good. There are all kinds of laws and rules today about what your car can be like, what shape its headlights can be, and how high its bumpers can be, and that sort of stuff. If the federal government says this particular car is wasteful or the horsepower on this engine is too high, the legal precedent to back up those sorts of decisions is very strong.
Could higher miles per gallon standards really reduce dependency on foreign oil?
Yes, and here's the interesting equation. Suppose we did put into force a one-third improvement in the average miles per gallon of new cars sold in the United States. In the first year of that program, there would be almost no effect. You'd save a few days' worth of the total amount of oil that we consume. But then the miracle of compounding comes into play. In the second year, there would be twice as many cars, fuel-efficient cars on the road. In the third year, three times as many, and so on. By just the fifth year of a one-third increase in the fuel economy of new cars sold in the United States, we would replace approximately the amount of oil the United States currently imports from the Persian Gulf. So to say that we could wean ourselves from Persian Gulf oil is not some wild pie-in-the-sky scheme. It's something that's reasonably practical with existing technology and something that we could do in about a decade. Detroit would need roughly 5 years of notice to adjust its production plans. Mm-hmm. And then you would need roughly 5 years of new vehicle sales, and then we could kiss the Persian Gulf goodbye. And that would be good for all concerned, I think.
All right. So it sounds as if Kerry versus Bush on the issue of fuel efficiency in vehicles, Kerry comes out ahead in your mind.
Yes, I think so. I think President Bush's environmental policies have not been anywhere near as bad as critics have made it sound. But I fault him for having very backward-looking energy policies. And I think in his case, President Bush is from the oil industry. Many people in his administration are. I don't demonize the oil industry like some people do. But I would point out that in the oil industry, for oil use to rise and oil prices to rise, those are good things. If you're in the oil industry, you want oil consumption and oil prices to go up. Those may be good things if you're in the oil industry. They are not good things for the country as a whole, and I think the president has failed to make that distinction.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with journalist Greg Easterbrook. What do President Bush and Senator Kerry think about coal, nuclear waste, drilling in the Arctic? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continue our conversation on energy. Someone's got to talk about it with journalist Greg Easterbrook. Greg, let's move beyond fuel efficiency and cars to coal. Compare the two candidates' positions on the issue of coal and clean coal systems specifically.
Well, President Bush has emphasized clean coal research. He's increased funding for it. The Bush administration is building a pilot program which will, in theory, enable them to burn coal with almost no pollution and with the greenhouse gases emitted by coal injected back into the earth where they come from. It's an interesting concept. John Kerry proposes to spend more on this. He wants to spend about $10 billion a year versus about $1 billion a year being spent by George Bush. Politically, everybody's in favor of clean coal. Every politician who's ever campaigned in West Virginia loves clean coal. I'm in favor of clean coal, too. It's just that you have to face the fact that clean coal systems cost significantly more than conventional coal combustion does. There are already practical clean coal combustion systems available and on the market that power companies could buy, and they do not because they cost quite a bit more than conventional systems. There's never going to be wide-scale use of clean coal systems to generate electricity unless government mandates it in some way, and neither Bush nor Kerry proposed to mandate the use of these systems. Mm.
You fault John Kerry in another area we're going to move to, which is storage of waste from power reactors. Talk about John Kerry's suggestions regarding Yucca Mountain and your thoughts about that.
Yes, the big issue in the nuclear power business right now is whether the Yucca Mountain Repository, which is in the middle of nowhere in Nevada, should be open. This has been under construction for more than a decade. It's been elaborately studied by the EPA, the National Academy of Sciences, and so on. It's a very complex, very carefully drawn-up project as a place to put the kind of waste that's left over when nuclear reactors burn uranium for power. Bush is in favor of it. Kerry is against it. The trouble in Kerry's case, I think, is two. One is the atomic power industry needs Yucca Mountain. Currently, there are 131 atomic waste sites around the country where wastes are being held in preparation to move them to Yucca Mountain. And second, Kerry criticizes this project without offering any alternative.
On the other hand, you fault President Bush for his support of drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, but not for some of the environmental reasons that some have pointed out.
The drilling at the North Slope oil fields, which are just to the west of ANWR in Alaska, has caused some but not serious environmental problems. And if ANWR were drilled, we would do that with technology that's 25 years more advanced and using rigs and other systems that have been designed to minimize harm. The environmental objections to ANWR are very mild. But if we were to drill ANWR, we should understand why we didn't do it. Bush suggested somehow this will be a replacement for foreign oil, and there's no way that the equations work. There wouldn't be enough oil coming out of ANWR to replace any major foreign source. The reason you would drill ANWR is to replace domestic, not foreign, supplies of oil. ANWR is not the solution to our Persian Gulf problems. Higher miles per gallon standards for cars and SUVs are the solution to that.
Greg Easterbrook, if you could, why don't you tick through for us a couple of items on each of the candidates' columns where you're disappointed in how they're presenting an issue, either because it doesn't reflect the reality of that issue or doesn't really reflect how the candidate feels.
Well, I'm very disappointed in George Bush because we hear him talk about energy independence. First, energy dependence is in itself not really necessary or practical. What we need is dependence from the Persian Gulf. That's where we need our independence. And Bush has had 4 years and done nothing at all to reverse the increase in demand for Persian Gulf oil. And for Kerry, he's on the right side of the miles per gallon issue. I think many of his other proposals are somewhat unrealistic. He talks about 20% of our electricity coming from renewable or green energy sources in the year 2020. There is no chance on earth that that will happen.
I was going to ask you as well. John Kerry is known to have, at least in the view of environmentalists, a terrific record on the environment. And yet, for instance, he rarely mentions greenhouse gases or global warming, as you note.
Neither of the candidates have talked much about greenhouse effect. And I think this is because polling data shows that voters consider this issue a total bummer. People think, and I think falsely for a reason I can tell you, that there's no solution to the greenhouse effect that won't cause grave sacrifices of our lifestyle. Some polls also show that people think that global warming and the greenhouse effect have become code words for surrendering authority to the United Nations. So John Kerry doesn't want to talk about them for that reason. Bush doesn't want to talk about him because he doesn't want to do anything that would disturb his oil constituency. Both guys have shied away from this issue, and we had a relatively cool summer this summer, so it wasn't in the headlines very much. But I actually think from having the experience in pollution control is that all previous air pollution programs have worked faster and better than expected and been cheaper than expected. This has certainly been true of smog control and acid rain control, both very successful at a much lower cost than anybody could have guessed. I think that greenhouse gas emission reduction, although a huge global problem, once we start working on it, will turn out to be more effective and cheaper than anybody now projects. Mm. But today, people don't want to talk about it because they look at these scary numbers for the year 2150 and figure that there's no hope.
And you point out that there's one president who had a terrible reputation when it came to this topic, but in fact had, as you say, long-ranging historical impact, and that's Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, the last president to care about energy policy or even do anything about it was Jimmy Carter. And although today we think of Jimmy Carter as an amiable bumbler on some issues, on energy policy, he made the three big historic moves. He deregulated sales of natural gas in the United States. He deregulated the price of petroleum, and he imposed the strong fuel economy standards on cars that took us from the land yachts of the 1970s to the reasonably efficient cars of the late 1980s. These three decisions had such fantastic effects, bringing out more supply of oil and gas, breaking the old OPEC price maintenance monopoly, and restraining America's rates of increasing consumption of petroleum, that every subsequent president since has been able to do nothing about energy policy because of the wise decisions Jimmy Carter made. But I think the time that Carter bought us is about to expire, and energy policy is going to have to become a centerpiece issue again.
Greg Easterbrook, thanks so much. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the fences aren't that crowded, but Americans are sitting on them, undecided voters. What else do they need to hear to help them make up their minds? Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With Election Day just 1 week away, the presidential candidates are logging lots of miles. President Bush and Senator Kerry are also getting most of the headlines. But there is a full field of third-party candidates running. Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb spent $40,000 crisscrossing the country just to gain the Greens' nomination. As the PBS film Crashing the Parties 2004 showed, Cobb didn't let a lack of financing prevent him from getting his message out.
I rent subcompacts, and if I can't get a subcompact, I get a compact like I've got now. And I carpool wherever possible. We're not going to be raising millions of dollars in this campaign, but we are going to be raising tens of thousands of dollars, maybe $100,000. And if I win the Green Party's nomination, I'm confident that we can raise probably about $250,000 or so.
And Green Party nominee and presidential candidate David Cobb now joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be back.
How much did you raise?
$150,000 and climbing.
So short of your goal of $250,000.
Just a little bit short, correct.
And some would say that you even had that goal reflected, maybe a naiveness. What is it that you are trying to do, given that so few people are even paying attention to the third-party candidates?
Well, I think it's interesting because alternative parties have been so profoundly important in American politics. The abolition of slavery, women getting the right to vote, the 40-hour work week, the Social Security Administration, unemployment insurance, the entire fabric of what we today think of as a just and compassionate society, that fabric had to be woven by alternative parties before us, alternative parties that were called naive and unrealistic, or alternative parties that were called dangerous and un-American for making their suggestions.
Well, tick off what your issues are.
For example, the Green Party is calling for an end to the war in Iraq and bring our troops home.
Let's stop right there, because a lot of people are saying, how can you be calling for that? It's the Pottery Barn. We broke it. We need to fix it. How can you be calling for them to come home?
Well, let's make it very clear. It's not in isolation. It's in conjunction with changing the entire U.S. foreign policy. But in Iraq, very specifically, if David Cobb, Green Party presidential candidate, was elected president, on November 3rd, I would issue a public acknowledgment to the world and the people of the United States that this war was waged illegitimately, predicated upon a series of lies of weapons of mass destruction that don't exist and lies around alleged links to al-Qaeda that were never there. Point two, issue a public apology to the people of Iraq as a result of the fact that this was an illegitimate war. Point three, immediately rescind every one of the corporate crony contracts that the Bush-Cheney administration has issued to Halliburton Corporation, Bechtel Corporation, and the rest of the huge corporate contributors to the Bush administration, and make those billions of dollars available to the people of Iraq to directly rebuild their own country. Step four would be to request the United Nations to convene a pan-Arabic peace summit where the civil society leadership of Iraq would be brought together, as well as the leadership of the Islamic world surrounding Iraq, at which the United States would come as a participant but not a convener, and say, step five, it is clear to us and the rest of the world and the Arabic world that the United States military is not viewed as an army of liberation. It's viewed as an army of occupation, and as such, the only appropriate, sane, rational thing to do is to withdraw our troops. If there is a need for a peacekeeping force, that force should come from the Islamic world, soldiers who speak Arabic, to ensure that we de-escalate the clash of civilizations.
I want to get to the rest of your platform, but I just quickly want to ask, a lot of people listening might agree with you, but then they might say, but in Afghanistan, I felt that was a just war. I felt it was just to go there after 9/11.
Well, I would disagree, because the reality is that the criminal act of the World Trade Center bombings were conducted by a series of individuals, not the people of Afghanistan, not the Afghani government.
Okay, because I want to give you the time that you deserve, let's move on to some of your other issues. You support increasing the minimum wage to a living wage. You support single-payer health insurance. What else?
Well, that's right. And let's just talk about raising the minimum wage to a living wage just means that we eliminate poverty by ensuring that everybody makes enough money to raise themselves above poverty as a result of their own labor and live in actual dignity. Single-payer universal health care is simply saying everybody ought to have health care as a fundamental human right. You know, we're calling for an end to a U.S. military policy that is based and premised upon protecting the interest of corporate interest rather than American interest. The Green Party is talking about implementing sustainable alternative energy sources to wean ourselves off of the addiction to oil that's driving not only these wars but also global warming.
You know, I want to ask you, these are your issues. Many people are familiar with many of them, but they're curious about what's happening with third-party candidates. For instance, Ralph Nader was the Green Party presidential nominee in 96 and 2000. You ran his campaign in Texas.
I did.
In 2000. What is the relationship between you and Ralph Nader? Because we heard stories of meetings with Green Party members pleading with him not to run and draw votes from the Democrats, but also taint some of the local Green Party races with his presence on the ticket.
Robin, I just want to acknowledge that this is a very dangerous and difficult election cycle for many progressives. John Kerry is a corporatist and a militarist. He's not a progressive. He voted for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for NAFTA. He voted for No Child Left Behind. He opposes universal health care. He opposes raising the minimum wage to a true living wage. But let's also tell the full truth about this election cycle. John Kerry may be bad, but George W. Bush is qualitatively worse.
Well, then the question to you is, are you doing the same thing by drawing votes from the Kerry candidate when, in fact, the money and the effort your huge effort might have been better spent invested in the local races, which Green Party candidates are winning?
We are winning. You know, the Green Party is getting larger, the Green Party is getting stronger, and the Green Party is getting better organized with every election cycle. And I would encourage people, don't waste your vote in Massachusetts. Invest your vote.
The reality, in other words, you think Kerry's going to win Massachusetts?
I think it, Robin. You think it. I bet even George Bush has had the Electoral College explained.
But what would a vote for you do in Massachusetts?
Well, if we get 3%, it keeps the Green Rainbow Party on the ballot, able to continue to run candidates for office. Mm-hmm. It also joins with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of other people who are saying that we want systemic change in this country.
I want to ask you about another one, because when many people think Green Party, they think the environment. And you just said that parties who are third parties usually run to really bring focus and attention to an issue that isn't being talked about. In the few seconds we have, nobody's talking about the environment. And you probably are, but people aren't hearing it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, isn't it? But the Green Party is talking about the environment. And in fact, at the local level where we're electing people, we are making the environment better, stopping toxic incinerators. And when Greens get elected to higher offices, we'll establish the Kyoto Protocol, we'll move to sustainable alternative energy sources. And even deeper, Robin, the Green Party is championing a new way of doing economics that's genuinely sustainable. And in this last moment, I want to encourage listeners, go to our website at votecobb.org, and look at the whole host of issues that we're championing, and ask yourself, if you're one of us, if you want to join the only political party that's rolling up our sleeves to take our country back from these corporate fat cats who've hijacked it.
David Cobb, thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be back here.
David Cobb, presidential candidate for the Green Party. He's on the ballot in 28 states. And still to come, Mo Rocca takes on all the president's pets. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, today we begin a look at the two main party candidates' policies regarding the environment. Reporter Lester Graham has this look at President Bush's environmental agenda.
President Bush doesn't often use the words environment or environmental. He prefers conservation. It's part of his philosophy. He believes we should manage resources and believes the government has tipped the scales too far in favor of preservationists at the expense of business and agriculture. On his Texas ranch, Mr. Bush likes to exercise by cutting brush to manage nature. It could be a metaphor for how he sees the larger issue. It seemed that way when he talked about his approach to the environment during the second debate.
I guess you'd say I'm a good steward of the land. The quality of the air is cleaner since I've been the president. Fewer water complaints since I've been the president. More land being restored since I've been the president.
While President Bush believes he's striking the right balance between conserving natural resources and not regulating business excessively, many environmentalists think the Bush administration's approach to environmental issues is way out of whack. Betsy Loyless is vice president of policy for the League of Conservation Voters. The LCV keeps track of votes and issues and grades politicians on their decisions.
League of Conservation Voters gave George Bush an F. The first F we've ever given out in modern history to a president, because his policies of anti-environmentalism spread across the board of dirty air, dirty water, and jeopardizing our energy future by focusing on 19th century energy policies that don't meet our 21st century needs.
President Bush largely ignores criticism from environmental groups. He sees them as extremists. On the campaign trail, he frames the debate about the environment in terms of finding a better balance between protecting the environment and keeping jobs.
If we want to keep jobs here in America and expand the job base, America must be the best place in the world to do business. That means less regulations on our business owners.
You would think that would make business and industry types happy. But even there, the president has his critics. The free market supporters are disappointed in George Bush. They feel he should have stuck to the ideas he had when he was running for president 4 years ago. Roll back regulations that some businesses say cost a lot of money with little benefit to the environment. The Property and Environment Research Center, self-described as the Center for Free Market Environmentalism, gave the president a C-minus grade on his midterm report card because the free market thinkers believe the Bush administration compromised its original proposals to please environmentalists and ended up pleasing no one. Even some in the president's own party are unhappy with the Bush administration's dealings with the environment. The group Republicans for Environmental Protection, backed by former Republican EPA administrators and other prominent Republicans, say the president got it wrong. Jim DePeso is the group's policy director. His group believes the Bush administration could have done more to protect the environment.
Well, our board took a look at the issue and decided that President Bush had not earned our support based on his record over the last 4 years. So because we have a policy of not endorsing Democrats, the only alternative we had was to simply withhold an endorsement for the presidential race this year.
But the majority of Republicans say the president is making progress on environmental issues. Lynn Scarlett is one of the architects of the Bush environmental policy. She's Assistant Secretary of the Department of Interior's Office of Policy Management and Budget.
This administration has the highest dollars ever expended by any administration going towards environmental protection, whether it's on the pollution side and pollution cleanup or on the land management and conservation side. We have a number of new programs the president initiated. So there's an awful lot that is occurring that is getting results on the ground.
President Bush believes the government should be partners with private landowners and industry, encouraging them to be more environmentally friendly instead of relying on regulations to mandate less pollution and better stewardship of the land. Environmentalists say that leaves too much to chance, and the potential cost to the planet is too dear.
That report from Lester Graham of the Great Lakes Radio Consortium, a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the George Gund Foundation and People and Land. You can learn more about Great Lakes Radio Consortium at glrc.org. Tomorrow, Lester examines the policies of John Kerry. Stay there. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Mo Rocca, the former Daily Show correspondent, has now taken on all the president's pets in his new novel of the same title. And as usual with Mo Rocca, there's just enough truth to make you wonder. He's funny, but is he serious? Mo joins us on the phone from New York. Hi.
Thank you, Robin.
Can we start first with sort of a true, false, you know, can we put the lightning round first? And,
sure.
And you promise me you'll answer honestly, okay?
Yep.
Okay. Does the Grover Cleveland birthplace in Caldwell, New Jersey really have a piece of his inaugural fruitcake?
True.
Did you really have First Lady flashcards your mother gave you when you were a kid?
True-ish. I bought them for myself.
Okay. And does Nora O'Donnell, the lovely correspondent for NBC, does she often say to you, "Hello, I'm NBC, you're MSNBC, Major Diff, got it?"
From the way she looks at me, she might as well be saying all of that.
Well, Rocca, I had a hard time at times figuring out truth from fiction in your fun and often serious new book. Are you really someone, did you really grow up in Washington, D.C., as you say, where other kids were into sports? You were into James Buchanan and Franklin Pierce, the president you couldn't remember were presidents?
Absolutely. I love the guys between Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt with all the facial hair. You know, they're mostly from Ohio. A couple of them were knocked off by anarchists. They fascinated me, and they continue to fascinate me. And the White House and the gates around it might as well have been Paramount Studios. It's the ultimate sort of star-making machine. I'm kind of tickled by it, and I think it's significant also. I mean, we need our presidents to be larger than life.
Yeah. And how did the president's pets play into it? Was this just a writing device, or were you as fascinated with them as you seem to be?
Well, I love lists. I know the capital of every country in the world. I know all of our state
flowers.
Whoa.
Uzbekistan.
Tashkent.
Oh, my gosh.
And believe me, when the Soviet Union broke up, I almost had a nervous breakdown. I mean, it was an explosion of stans. I mean, it took me weeks to get everything straight. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I started learning everything about all the presidential pets. There are 7 books written on the subject. I own 5 of them. You can probably get by on just 3. I mean, after that, they kind of start repeating themselves. I mean, what more can you say about Benjamin Harrison's goat? There's just not that much ground to break. But at the same time that I was studying these pets, I was very interested in the process of presidential decision-making. You know, the run-up to the Iraq War really made me think a lot about that. That decision was not scrutinized by the press, I think, very well at all. So, you know, I started to think, what is it that presidents are hiding? Why don't we know how they make these big decisions or much about them at all? And then I put 2 and 2 together and I thought, okay, maybe it's that they're being influenced by something that would really undermine the image of infallibility that they've so carefully cultivated. And what could be more humbling than having your dog make a decision for you?
And that leads us to your story plot. You're an intrepid White House correspondent assigned to cover the president's dog, Barney, but Fox reporter Lori Due has exclusive access to the dog. Then you discover reporter Helen Thomas in a basement bunker where she reveals to you the mystery of the presidents and their pets and how those pets help shape foreign policy. Have I got that
well,
right?
Well, I mean, I assume that most people already knew that she lives underneath the White House in a subterranean lair where she's the keeper of the presidential pet archives. But Helen Thomas is always someone I admired because she was willing to be ridiculed and even alienated for asking questions that other people for whatever reason, refused to ask. In fact, last year in an infamous press conference, for the first time in her career, she wasn't allowed to ask a question. As the dean of the White House press corps, she's supposed to ask the first question by tradition and was not called on at all by President Bush. And so I thought, look, this woman needs to be the hero of this book. And plus, I just wanted to be in a thriller with her. I mean, I'd always imagined us in sort of a Stephanie Powers, Robert Wagner kind of heart-to-heart relationship. And so, yes, she unspools the secrets of the presidential pets. And she, and through this, again, she demonstrates to me that, you know, presidents, the men who occupy this office, have all been quite fallible and quite impressionable.
What did you find out? I mean, why is it important that William Howard Taft had a Holstein cow or that Woodrow Wilson had a gentle sheep?
Well, those two examples are examples of presidents that really match their pets in temperament. I mean, William Howard Taft, well, in his case, physicality, was a very fat man. And so it was fitting that he had a cow named Pauline. And Woodrow Wilson was, I'd like to think, I wouldn't call him a peacenik, but he definitely, you know, his quest to have the United States join the League of Nations definitely makes him somebody who was an ardent advocate of peace, and so it was appropriate that he had sheep. His ram, Old Ike, of course, died of a nicotine addiction on a Maryland farm, which is very sad. But these aren't coincidences. The pets are sort of leading here.
Mm. As you say, only Millard Fillmore did not have a pet.
Well, those who are scholars in the field of presidential pets will tell you that. That's conventional wisdom. But, of course, this book reveals that that's not the case, and I can't say any more without giving it away, but I will tell you that Helen Thomas, who enjoyed an idyllic girlhood with Sacagawea and an illicit relationship with Millard Fillmore, is more than happy in the end to reveal the truth to me.
Mm. Well, I'm looking at the picture on page 8. I'm assuming this is a real photograph. It apparently is of President Bush dropping Barney.
Well, people remember that. He dropped Barney on the tarmac at Waco Airport. You'll notice that Bush has a look of astonishment on his face, and I believe it's because Barney is talking to him, and the president doesn't really understand what he's being told. Now, I won't tell you now what he's being told because I need people to read the book.
Wait, Mo Rock, that could explain the bulge in President Bush's jacket. Well, you know, people have thought that this was a transistor and that
right.
Karl Rove was speaking in President Bush's ear during the debate. Could have been Barney.
It could have been, or it might have just been a chew toy he left behind or something, you know. The people have to know. People have to know that the president is not this omniscient figure.
Yeah. As
that no president is.
As we head into the election, there's some goofy stuff here, but I'm also reading that you take your politics and your history and the role of the press pretty seriously.
Well, I do, but I take also what a lot of people think is silly seriously, because the silly sometimes makes the difference. You know, the president in this country is both the head of government and the head of state, whereas in the UK, you know, the prime minister is the head of government and they have a monarch to do the head of state symbolic work. So people don't demand that Tony Blair be the regular Joe, or, you know, they don't really care about, you know, if he clears brush and what sports he plays. But we impose all of that on our chief executive. So that stuff all matters, for better or for worse. So, yeah, I like to pay attention to their hair, their pets, and look for patterns. Patterns run throughout our history. For instance, the man with a screwed-up younger brother usually wins. Billy Carter, Sam Houston Johnson. It goes back to Thomas Jefferson's brother, Randolph. They're just all sorts of patterns that have nothing to do with policy and positions.
And leave us one thought on patterns having to do with pets.
Well, as Harry Truman said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. And it's ironic because he exiled both of his dogs. His Irish setter Mike, he claimed, contracted rickets after the Secret Service gave him candy. I think it's all a lie. It's a ruse. But it depends. There's, you know, this race, I suppose, does come down to two dogs, Kerry's German Shepherd and Bush's Scotty. The German Shepherd is a deliberate, thoughtful breed. It has a strong military background, bred by Captain Max von Stefanitz for German World War I troops. It can come off as aloof sometimes. The Scotty is a tenacious, low-to-the-ground dog. It was bred for ratting, for killing vermin in houses and barns. It's feisty, rash, impulsive, some might say preemptive. It's likable, though.
I've never heard anyone say Scotty was preemptive, but there you go. Mo Rocca, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Mo Rocca's new book is called All the President's Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over. I have a preemptive chihuahua, actually. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.